Last week we began another look at faith from Hebrews chapter 11. If you've got your Bibles, you can turn with me to Hebrews chapter 11. Last week we looked at Moses from the book of Exodus, particularly at the time in his experience when he was a fine, beautiful baby. That's how we saw him last week, because we were studying the faith of his parents, a faith which gave them a certain kind of clarity and a certain kind of courage to do what they needed to do at great risk to themselves in order to save their baby's life. Their faith saved Moses' life. So he got to grow up. Exodus chapter 2 tells the story of how when they could no longer hide him from the king in regard to the king's edict to have all male babies put to death, they did what they were ordered to do, that is, they put their baby in the Nile River, but with a difference. They put him in a waterproof basket. And you can read the story in Exodus chapter 2 and come to the conclusion that they were really looking for a miracle, because Moses' older sister stood by to see what would happen next. And what do you know? What happened next? The Pharaoh's daughter came down to the river with her maidservants. And that wouldn't have been a random event, I don't think. It must have been a common knowledge that there was a place where the royal family went down to the river. At any rate, Moses' life was spared, and he got to grow up. And when we get to verse 11 of Exodus chapter 2, we see him all grown up. And we see an incident which defined the next 40 years of his life, not in a desirable way. And then we'll go to Hebrews chapter 11 and see what to make of it. So here's our text from Exodus chapter 2, the story that we'll be building a case for faith on, verse 11 and 12. One day, it says, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens. So here's the young man, now all grown up, has had an opportunity to grow up under the provision of the daughter of the Pharaoh, to grow up like a prince. He went out to his people, that is, he went out of the palace, went to his people, who, like his parents, were slaves serving the Egyptians, and he looked on the burden of their slavery. And then the action really begins. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. Just the sort of thing that was happening all the time, as the Egyptians, using the Hebrews as slaves, sought to keep the Hebrews under their oppression. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian, which is to be understood as murder. He killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Moses' actions were questionable, for sure. They define the next 40 years of his life, because in actual fact, he wasn't able to keep the body of the man he killed a secret. And soon he was running for his life, and he stayed away from the palace, and in fact, away from Egypt for 40 years. We talked last week about how faith inspires clarity and courage, how clarity and courage inspires faith. Was there courage in Moses' action? Well, you could say, sort of. He freed a Hebrew from a beating by beating up, in fact, by killing the man who was beating his fellow countrymen, the Hebrew. But looking both ways to make sure that no one was there to watch, and then hiding the body in the sand, that doesn't seem quite like courage. But you could say it was sort of courageous. If it didn't lack courage entirely, his action lacked clarity. Because if he had some sort of hunch that God was calling him to liberate his people from slavery, it wasn't very clear thinking for him to imagine that the way to do that was to knock off the whole nation of Egypt, one Egyptian at a time. But when we go to Hebrews chapter 11 to study faith, we see that at the back of his willingness to go out to his people and look on their burdens and be involved in their troubles, there was some faith. So this morning we have two notes about Moses and the choice that faith made, his faith made choices. And our purpose for lingering in Hebrews chapter 11 and looking at faith made choices for these 4 weeks is to stay in a place of encouragement in regard to the opportunities that God has given us. Because as we saw last month, and I hope it's really clear in your mind still, what God enables us to do, what he has given us, is often specifically an assignment from him, an opportunity to take, whether it's an opportunity to do a one-off act of kindness or whether it's an opportunity to embark on a whole new adventure of life. The M and the A and the T and the E, the money and the abilities and the time and the energy He gives us ought to be seen as the raw materials out of which an opportunity can be taken. If we have the faith, if we trust God enough to take the opportunity. Faith makes choices of that sort. And that's what we saw last week. That there's a clarity and a courage that comes with trusting ourselves to God, with trusting God enough to obey Him. And what we see in Moses' example specifically are the sorts of choices that the clarity and the courage of faith sets us up for. So let's think about Moses and his faith in order to understand more about the sorts of choices that God might be prompting us to be courageous enough and clear-minded enough to take. Note number one. By faith, Moses refused the world and its things. I'm using that in a sort of specific technical sense. It comes from the New Testament. I'll show you in a bit where it comes from. But let's look at our actual text. It's Hebrews chapter 11. Here's the account of the Exodus chapter 2 story in regard to Moses' faith. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. There in those three verses is a summary of this particular point, episode in Moses' life. And what you see him doing here is refusing by faith a whole lot of what the world had been set up to offer him. I want you to think with me about these refusals that faith prompted Moses to make. And as we think about them, I'd love you to see with me just how easy it would have been for him to justify not refusing these things. How easy it would have been for him to refuse these things. It actually worries me that it's so easy to make a case for why Moses should not have refused the world and its things. Let's just look together at these verses. What we've got here is a statement that by faith Moses refuses to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He refused the honor of continuing to be seen as a grandson of the emperor, a grandson of Pharaoh, because of his sort of adopted relationship with the Pharaoh's daughter. But how easy it would have been for him to say, I don't consider it an accident that when my parents finally did put me in the Nile River, they put me in a waterproof basket and placed me exactly in the location where the Pharaoh's daughter would find me. I don't consider it an accident, he might have said, that she had pity on me and took me to be raised in the palace as if I were her son. He could have said, I call it providence. It's no accident that I'm here in a position of privilege. It's no accident at all. He could have said that. And actually, you know, theologically, none of us would want to argue. We don't want to say, no, it was just sheer luck, Moses. No, the purposes of God were all over the incident by which not only was his life saved, but he was actually incorporated into the Pharaoh's palace, grew up there. And so as an adult was seen as a grandson of the Pharaoh. But we have here the statement that he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He refused the privilege. But there's more details. It says in our text that he refused to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin, which is to say that if he had stayed in the palace, he would have had a great time because there's all sorts of opportunities to enjoy himself, all kinds of pleasures which he could have embraced. And by faith, he refused to just live in the pleasures of the court of Pharaoh. But it would have been so easy for him to justify staying there. He could have said, it's no accident that I'm here in the palace. From my position in the palace, I'm going to be able to do my people great good. But of course, you know, I've got to fit in. So I've got to dress like I belong in the palace. The finest of clothes. And I need to eat the sort of food a prince eats. I mean, I can't hardly miss all the banquets, can I? In fact, if I go to the banquets and enjoy the food, I'll have an opportunity to have an impact on other people in the palace. Very important that I, you know, keep up with the other people, the other sons of the other daughters of the Pharaoh. By faith, he refused to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin, but he could easily have said, by staying in the palace. I'm looking at decades and decades of doing the work of God. He saw the pleasures of sin as a fleeting thing to be refused, but he could have seen it as an opportunity to do good for the rest of his life. And our text also says that he refused the treasures of Egypt. But he could have considered his opportunity to advocate for the slaves who were his countrymen as one of the greatest treasures of his life. He could have written his memoirs about how God opened a door for him to do something on the inside that needed to be done. And if at the end of his long life of luxurious living in the palace, the slaves had a bit better time, not so much oppression, maybe they had better living quarters or better food, he could have died a happy man, saying, I did not waste the opportunity. I lobbied for their better provision. And I believe, he would have said as he was dying, that the slaves are better off for me having stayed right here in the palace. And he didn't do that at all. What really intrigues me about this as I think about it is that if he were trying to justify staying in the palace, the very best case he could have made for doing so, that is, for refusing to refuse, is to simply look back in the records of God's people, in whatever form those records were written at that time, at the important person that God had used previously. I mean, we have our Bible. We have the story of Moses making his refusal in Exodus chapter 2. Just go back a page, you get to Genesis chapter 50, and in fact, the whole second half of the book of Genesis, from chapter 37 to 50, is all about one particular Hebrew man, Joseph, who through a strange set of circumstances ended up in the palace of the Pharaoh in a position of influence from which he saved his nation's life. That's the story of Joseph. It eventually takes over the whole book of Genesis. And all Moses needed to do was say, I'm the next Joseph. Circumstances allowed me to be where Joseph was. And it's really worth our while to realize that Joseph was not in any way faulted for staying in Pharaoh's court. In fact, he got there in order to save the people. He saved them from famine. You can read it for yourself in the book of Genesis as part of the design of God. And then a little while later, in the days when there was a Pharaoh who didn't know about Joseph, and the plight of God's people became very, very serious, Moses has this great opportunity to work on the inside and once again to liberate the slaves. But by faith, by trusting God enough to obey him, he recognizes this is not the way to go. And by faith, he refused the world and all of its things. And our text gives us more specific details about what his faith gave him the clarity and courage to do, which is note 2. By faith, Moses chose to suffer like Christ. The text itself shows us why we can explain his choice that way. Here it is again. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ, that's where we get the phrase, the reproach of Christ, greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. So let's stay a little while longer right on the text and consider this bold, courageous, clear choice that faith compelled him to make. He chose to be mistreated with the people of God. He trusted God enough to obey him when God led him away from all the luxuries of the palace to go live with the slaves. And you know the story if you're familiar with the content of the book of Exodus and then Leviticus and Numbers of Deuteronomy. In not too long a time after the plan of God unfolded and he had liberated the people of Israel from their enslavement to Pharaoh and the Egyptians, he was living out in the wilderness. He lived with them, the people of God, for a long, long time. And the elements mistreated them. And all kinds of hostile forces in the wilderness mistreated them. And it was Moses' faithful choice to be mistreated with the people of God. By faith, we read, He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. There were the treasures of Egypt. He could have justified enjoying them, but he considered it greater wealth to embrace the reproach of Christ, which is why I'm saying as note two, by faith Moses chose to suffer like Christ. There's a number of ways of understanding this idea of considering the reproach of Christ greater wealth, but I think what we're supposed to understand is that by obeying God, by saying yes to God, he was doing essentially what Jesus was doing when he took up his cross. He was saying yes to God along the same lines, under the same terms as Jesus was saying when Jesus agreed to the cross, when Jesus agreed to be crucified. That is, he took upon himself all of the pain and all of the shame and all of the death of being crucified because this is what God was calling Jesus to do. And Moses, similarly, entrusting himself to God, trusting God enough to obey him, considered it to be a greater wealth to be doing the will of God with the physical suffering, the inconvenience, the difficulties, and the shame rather than anything else, even the treasures of Egypt. It's the reproach of Christ in the sense that it was the same sort of reproach that Christ took upon himself when he agreed to the will of God for himself, for his life. So Moses took on reproach in order to be faithful to God's calling on his life. And we see as well that by faith, he was looking to the reward. He had lots of rewards he had to turn away from. He had to refuse if he wanted to get in on the rewards of obeying God. And there's this clarity, seeing that it would be better to suffer in this world in order to fulfill the will of God than to avoid suffering if it means turning away from the will of God. Moses is our example. And happily, he's not our only example. He's centuries before the birth of Christ and thousands of years before us, and there he is. His record is permanently encapsulated in the Bible for us. But we can look beyond Moses, on into the future, a future that Moses could only have tried to imagine, in order to see many other examples of the same sort of thing. So let me tell you about a church in Toronto. It's one of our churches. It's an Alliance church. It's in Scarborough. It's a Chinese Alliance church, and interestingly is named Toronto Jaffray Chinese Alliance Church. It's a Chinese Alliance Church in Toronto that's named after a man who grew up in Toronto, Robert Jaffray. Robert Jaffray was born in the 1870s. He was born as the son of Robert Jaffray Sr., who owned a newspaper called the Toronto Globe. Later, it became known as the Globe and Mail. He was born in high society. He was born a very, very wealthy young man. And his father, loving him dearly and being so successful in business, planned for him to take over the newspaper and the whole publishing enterprise and to wield the kind of influence that he himself was wielding while Robert was growing up. And then in the 1890s, when he was just a young man, our Robert Jaffray had an interaction with Albert B. Simpson, who is the founder of the Christian Missionary Alliance. And in his interaction with Simpson, he heard the call of God to give it all up and go to China as a missionary. Now, you got to put the story in its context. This is the 1890s. To go to China to live in the 1890s from Toronto, Ontario, would be more like going to another planet than it is for us to go to another country. You go across the world, and if you survive the voyage, which was in fact an actual risk in those days, well, you weren't going to be Skyping your girlfriend every night, or emailing home, or even telephoning. It was really sort of goodbye to everyone. So in his early 20s, he told his father, his rich, powerful father, that he sensed that God was calling him to China. And his father was not the least bit pleased. His father said, if the Christian and Missionary Alliance sends you to China, they'll do it on their own dollar. I myself will not give a single dime to the enterprise. And then he said, speak well of a father on Father's Day, but if you ever change your mind, just let me know, and I'll pay for your way home. So at the age of 24, Robert Jaffray, who wasn't in very good health. He had a heart condition and diabetes. And these are the 1890s. At the age of 24, this rich kid refused the world and all its things and chose to suffer like Christ. He moved to China, where he served the Lord faithfully for 35 years and did great good in China. In Hong Kong, he established a seminary from which many others like him were trained to do the work of the Lord, the work of the gospel. He served in Indonesia as well as in China. He established a publishing company, go figure, and a newspaper. He had the expertise, he had the wherewithal, he knew how to do that. And he served faithfully for 35 years until 1942 when the Japanese invaded and they imprisoned him in an internment camp. And over the next 3 years, he lost his health through malnourishment and other diseases. And in 1945, the year that the war was ending, he died. So he gave up all that God had given him back in Toronto. And he set aside all the ways in which he could rationalize taking over the empire, the newspaper, and in a position of influence, serving God from his home in Rosedale. And instead he went to China. And I want you to compare Moses to Joseph to reckon on the fact that it might have been the will of God for Robert Jaffrey to stay in Toronto and use his influence as a publisher. I mean, would it not have been great to have such a committed Christian publishing the dominant newspaper in Toronto? That would have been a great thing. And it would have been the right thing for someone, but Robert Jaffrey sensed it wasn't the right thing for him to do, and he had the faith to refuse and to choose with clarity and courage. And he remains an example to us all. And in Scarborough, there's a group of Chinese Christians who are grateful to God that some rich kid from Toronto decided to go to another planet across the Pacific, to the country of China, and spend the next 3.5 decades serving faithfully in the ministry of the gospel. An example to them. They honor him by giving their church a name which remembers him. And he's an example to us, as is Moses. So here's a couple of actions for us to take to heart and perhaps to put into place this week as we think about the opportunities God is challenging us, daring us to take, whatever the cost. Action A. Actions based on the example of Moses. Here's A. By faith, let's do the same. Let's refuse to love the world and its things. And we talk about refusing to love the world. We're not using the word love and the word world the way John 3:16 does, God so loved the world. But we're using the word love and the word world the way the Apostle John does in his first letter, 1 John 2. Here's the text. John says, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. And then very helpfully, the Apostle explains what he means by the world that we're not to love. All that's in the world, the desires of the flesh, what you feel like doing, and the desires of the eyes, what you love to look on, and pride in possessions, that satisfaction that comes from having really neat things. It's not from the Father, but it's from the world. And the world is passing away, along with its desires, along with the fleeting pleasures of sin. John says, but whoever does the will of God abides forever. This is a call to action. We're called to be the sorts of people who could walk away from every good thing that God has given us, even if it's totally possible for us to look at a Bible character like Joseph and say, there's no need for me to give it all away. It's come into my life so that I can serve God. And in Joseph's case, that was true. But God calls us to trust him enough to obey him when he calls us to be more like Moses than Joseph and walk away from it all rather than love it. And we need to live in a state of readiness for a great big Moses moment and a great big Moses refusal. We need to be ready for a great big Robert Jaffray moment with all the Robert Jaffray refusals that come into the obedience that God calls us to live. But we can live a long time just waiting for our big moment, because in actual fact, most of us are far less extraordinary than Robert Jaffrey was, far less important people in the story than Moses was. Let's get used to it. Most of us are called to live exemplary, normal lives where the great big refusals are never actually imposed upon us. So my application for you this week in terms of refusing by faith to love the world and its things is to just stay in shape, or to get in shape in regard to the faith required, the clarity and courage of faith required to say no to the things of the world whenever God calls you to do so. It takes practice. Maybe this is a week in which we could practice. So that would mean, perhaps, you know, develop the mindset by which you're willing to suffer in order to turn away from short-term pleasures in order to get in on longer-term benefits. Which would mean, you know, just don't go to the spa this week, you know, where everything feels good. Also, go to the gym, where if you use the equipment properly, everything feels bad. Choose the gym. Or the spa and the gym. The gym and then the spa. And don't just go for a walk, because it's June, and it's so pleasant to walk. But go for a run, which if you do it properly is not pleasant at all. If it's pleasant, you're not running fast enough. And don't just show up in the dining room for a feast, giving thanks to God for the wonderful food that's just come off the barbecue for your pleasure. Don't just go to the dining room table for a feast. Go to your prayer closet for a fast. Yeah. Fasting always gives you a headache. Embrace the headache. Tame your appetites. Another famous Alliance guy, A.W. Tozer, was asked, how long should we fast? And he said in his charming way, as long as it takes for your stomach to catch on to the fact that it's not in charge of you. So we should learn to fast. We should learn to say no to food as well as we are able to say yes to food. Days of feasting, days of fasting, that's the plan. And listen, don't just set out a candy dish full of candies so that whenever you decide to treat yourself with a little shot of sugar, you can do so. But set out a candy dish loaded with candies so that at times when you feel like a little shot of sugar, you refuse to. That's a good purpose for a candy dish. Very godly thing to have a candy dish set out if you get the hang of not dipping into it. By faith, let's refuse to love the world. You know, I don't really think we have nearly enough heckling. But that was great. Appreciate all you do for the church. You know, if it's on topic, it can be really like a helpful teaching thing. Action B. By faith, let's choose to think and act like Christ. This is to choose the reproach of Christ as greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. We should be these people with clarity and courage. By faith, we should choose to think and act like Christ. And he called us to act like him. He called us to imitate him. Here's what he said in Luke chapter 9. Jesus says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. We are called to take up our cross every day, which I think, you know, the word daily suggests many little yeses to God, many little no's to God, as you prepare yourself, as you train yourself to be the sort of person who could make a great big yes to God. Taking up the cross, understood in those days, was to agree to the shame of crucifixion, to agree to the pain of crucifixion, to agree to the death of crucifixion in order to say yes to God. And that kind of yes to God requires a great emphatic no to your own feelings, to your flesh, and to the world and all that the world is offering you so as not to say yes to God, and to the devil. The world and the flesh and the devil are all on the opposite side, and we need to be opposed to them and able to say no to them in order to think and act like Christ. And his life is an example to us of that. Do you remember this from 1 Peter chapter 2? The apostle says, if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. If doing good causes you to suffer and you endure in the suffering involved in doing good, that's a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you've been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you, do you remember this from our study of 1 Peter? Leaving you an example so that you might follow in His steps. Jesus left us an example. And that word translated example is a Greek word that means underwriting. It's two Greek words. It means underwriting. When a tutor was teaching his pupil how to print, he would etch lightly on the slate the letters that he was wanting the pupil to learn, and those letters on the slate were called the underwriting. And we get our word example from that in this text. And then the pupil came along and wrote over top of the letters that the tutor had written so he'd learn how to do his letters. And the details of the life of Jesus are the underwriting, the example he's given to us, so that we can see what he did and imitate him. There's lots of ways to be changed in our behavior by doing what we understand Jesus would do. But we know some things that he did do, and we don't have to speculate. When it came time to pick up his cross, he set aside all of his apprehension and reluctance to be ashamed and to be pained and to be killed. He said yes to God. And he did so not only to provide us with salvation through his death on the cross and the forgiveness of sins, but he did so as an example. He left us an example so that we might follow in his steps. So let's choose to think and act like Christ and say no to our own feelings if required in order to say yes to God. And let's get away from thinking short term about what it means right now. Always choosing what would feel good right now is a deadly thing. But saying yes to God is not a matter of refusing joy, as if God doesn't want his people to be happy. Saying yes to God is a matter of choosing eternal joy instead of short-lived joy. Permanent pleasures instead of fleeting pleasures. And this we get, in summary, from where Hebrews 11 is going. And we've seen over the last couple of months repeatedly how all of Hebrews 11, the examples that are cited there, are set up for Hebrews 12. So let me go there and close. The writer says, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, Moses, for example, let us also lay aside every weight, the weight of all the luxuries of the court of Pharaoh, for example, and let us lay aside sin, which clings so closely. It would have been a sin for Moses to refuse God when God was setting him up to liberate his people, but he had to do it in God's way. And let us run with endurance the race that's set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross. Classic case of turning away from the fleeting pleasures of escaping crucifixion in order to get in on the permanent pleasures that were set before him and which he needed to endure the cross in order to get in on. So he despised the shame. He put aside the shame. He despised the pleasures of refusing to be crucified. He despised the shame and is now seated at the right hand of the throne of God. The writer says, think about him. Think about Jesus. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. I've said it before, for some of you, the opportunity God is calling you to take isn't anything new. It's just with more wholeheartedness, with more courage and clarity, embracing the opportunity God has given you. But it wouldn't be much fun if we all just stuck to what we're already doing. It wouldn't be good for the church if we just decided, this is as much as we can accomplish. No one's taking any new opportunities. There will be opportunities that some of us should take to get involved in new things. And if God gives us the clarity and courage of faith to make faith-made choices, some of us will find ourselves gladly following Moses' example, which is gladly following the example of Jesus, choosing to suffer the reproach of Christ, because we see the treasure that can only be obtained through that obedience. Let's pray together. Lord, we thank you for what you have written in your word, the underwriting of the example of Jesus, which shows us that we all have some tough choices ahead of us when we have to choose whether we're going to obey our own flesh, our own feelings, our own fears, or whether we're going to embrace your will, set aside all those other things. And I pray you'll give us clarity, Lord, that we will not be confused, that we will not overestimate our importance, but not underestimate the opportunities. Lord, give us clarity to understand your will and the courage to say yes to you and then no to whatever needs to be refused. Thank you for what we have learned in your word. Help us, Lord, not just to be hearers, learners, but doers and riskers and obeyers to the glory of Christ. Amen.